This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. The sounds of Motown in the 60s and 70s are still part of American history. And whether you wanted to fall in love or fight the power, Motown spoke a language that all races in this country embraced. Billie Holiday began singing in nightclubs in Harlem in the late 20s. By the late 40s, her crossover commercial success had her selling out Carnegie Hall. The contributions of African Americans to the music landscape of this country are undeniable. And each June since 1979, the country celebrates Black Music Month. Joining us to talk about the tradition is musicologist Georgerie Bledsoe, founder and executive director of Bump the Triangle. Welcome back, Georgerie.
It's so good to be here, Frank.
Talk about this Black Music Month and the creation of this, how it got created.
Sure. So let's start with the background. As you said, in the 60s and 70s, Black radio, companies were really hot. And the mainstream companies wanted to get in on this. So CBS actually commissioned a study from Harvard University, the business school, to find out how to get in on it. And the study said you need to start these divisions, you need to bring in Black executives. By the end of the 70s, the music was strong, but Blacks no longer had economic control over it. So Kenny Gamble was really interested in having an impact on that. He said, let's start the Black Music Association. And the first initiative was Black Music Month. For him, it was really about the business side of things. And he came up with a slogan that said, Black music is green. So the first Black Music Month celebration was in 1979. It was celebrated on the lawn of the White House, hosted by Jimmy Carter. But, you know, the funny thing about that is it wasn't until the late 1990s that one of the founders found out that it wasn't an official celebration. And it was President Bill Clinton that actually passed legislation.
Yeah, it would be funny if it was Billy Carter, because if you're... No, it wasn't him. It was Bill Clinton. So it's a fascinating history, too, and the trajectory, because it starts out in the Jim Crow era. Even our music is segregated all across the country, not just in the South. The Black music industry, those records were known as race records, right? And the white recording industry was happy to let that system go until the crossover success of Motown, Stax, and the other record companies that were penetrating white markets. So then it becomes a commercial success, and now it's like, how do we get in on this?
That's exactly right. So almost every genre of American music was created by African Americans. And so the sense was that how do we really find out how to market this? And so it was the study that helped to make that happen.
In 2009, Barack Obama renamed it, I guess, African American Music Appreciation Month.
Right. You know, Black Music Month had the idea behind it that it was not just African Americans who were contributing to this music, but Black people from Africa, from the Caribbean. And so renaming it African American Music Month really does put a different spin on things and focuses now on American music.
But it's interesting because the cultural contribution and the cultural value in all of this is critical. And that's what we're talking about. It cannot be divorced from its commercial component because that's how it becomes public. And I mean, even if you look at the way it crossed over, somebody like Berry Gordy is very conscious of making his artists look appealing to what he considers a white audience. So he understands that crossover, both commercially, right, and culturally. So from the start, this has been an American art form brought to us through the African diaspora to this country.
So, you know, when you bring up the African diaspora, I think it's so critical to realize that African music has so many different ways. Artists bring different ways of being to the music. And it was the music of Africa that sort of generated all this, right? With the calls, cries, and hollers and the spirituals. And then all of that gets put into African American music. And sometimes we don't really take the time to understand that deep history. And that's why Black Music Month is so important. You know, we're never going to, we're always going to keep that colloquial name Black Music Month. I hope you realize that.
Yeah, that's it. And that's how it's branded. And I think we'll be that way forever. But my question is, what do you think has been the success or the impact, if not even success, both commercially and culturally since 1979?
I'm not sure. You know, I was having a discussion about that with someone the other day. I'm not sure what the economic success of Black Music Month has been, but it is critical in providing a moment for us to come back and consider the impact of this music on our culture.
I want to talk more about this. I'm talking now to musicologist Georgerie Bledsoe about the origins of Black Music Month. And joining the conversation now is poet and children's book author, one who has made a living telling the stories of African-American leaders, many of whom were musicians. Carol Boston Weatherford is an English professor at Fayetteville State University. Her latest book is The Roots of Rap, 16 Bars on the Four Pillars of Hip Hop. Carol, welcome back to the State of Things.
Glad to be here, Frank.
Tell us about the many ways, I guess, that African-Americans, and particularly in your books, the way, because you're obviously targeting children, you want kids to understand and know about this history, right?
Well, I start out, I really have looked at the evolution of African-American music, and it kind of started with my book, The Sound That Jazz Makes, in 1999, which looked at African-American music going back. It looked at the evolution of jazz in particular, and it connected the African rhythms that Georgerie discussed with jazz, and even touched on hip-hop toward the end of that book. And that was kind of a survey of the history of African-American music, but with the focus on jazz. There happened to have been one stanza in the book about R&B, and that ended up getting cut because there was not enough pages to accommodate more illustrations. So I started with that and then kind of looked at some of the people who I had mentioned in that book, Billie Holiday being one of them, John Coltrane being another. Lena Horne wasn't mentioned, but I've in that particular book, but I've written about her as well. So I try to reintroduce and in some cases introduce kids to the roots of African-American music, and particularly to jazz, because most kids don't listen to jazz.
You go into some detail in those roots in your book, Freedom in Congo Square. Tell us about that and the story that's told in that book.
Congo Square is a place in the Treme neighborhood of New Orleans, present-day Treme neighborhood. During the slavery era, Louisiana was a place that had a Sabbath law, and so even enslaved people had off on Sunday afternoons. And unlike some other places in the South where Africans, free blacks and enslaved blacks were not allowed to gather without white supervision, in New Orleans, they were allowed to do that. And not only were they allowed to gather, they were able to practice their African religions, speak African tongues, and most importantly, play their drums. And as a result of that, New Orleans really preserved African culture, African rhythms, and the drumming tradition and some of the other traditional African instruments that were used. And that really led to New Orleans being the birthplace of jazz, the fact that Congo Square existed.
Right, and I think that's probably something that we don't recognize, appreciate enough. Why is Louisiana, why is New Orleans the place where we go when we think about jazz? And this is part of the reason, and not only permitted to congregate, but as you say, permitted to use drums because they were outlawed in,
exactly,
in the rest of the state.
So exactly.
This is where it's brought forward and then moved forward into musical traditions. I wonder if you could just give us a sample of that book to give us a sense of how you try to make, you know, make this story come alive.
Sure. And let me just preface that with the fact that Congo Square is part of Louis Armstrong National Historic Site in New Orleans, present-day New Orleans. It was a market and a gathering ground where African music could resound. Beneath the sun and the open air, the crowd abuzz as news was shared. Grouped by nation, language, tribe, they drummed ancestral roots alive. They played triangles, gourds, and bells, bonzas, flutes, fiddles, and shells. They danced as if they had no cares, half day, half free, in Congo Square. This piece of earth was a world apart. Congo Square was freedom's heart.
That's an excerpt from Freedom in Congo Square. And that was written and read by Carol Boston Weatherford. I'm also talking with musicologist Georgery Bledsoe. So, Georgery, talk about the trajectory then. It's one thing to say we've got the day off and we can become ourselves for this day and listen to our music. But how does it move out from New Orleans and become part of our tradition? Give us some sense of where it goes from there.
Well, you know, the Mississippi River played a huge role in that, right? As the Great Migration started, African Americans were coming up to places like St. Louis and Chicago and landing there from the Mississippi Delta up to Chicago, Muddy Rivers, B.B. King, and it starts to spread out from there.
Carol, you've called Billie Holiday your muse. Talk about her role in all of this and why she's so important to you.
My dad introduced me to Billie Holiday's music, not, by way of Carol, sit down, listen to Billie Holiday, but he was a jazz fan, and I listened to Billie Holiday because that was what was playing in the house. But when I was 16 years old, he took me to see the movie Lady Sings the Blues, and I became a Billie Holiday fan in my own right. And many years later, I realized that she was my muse, and I wrote Becoming Billie Holiday, which is a fictional verse memoir chronicling her first 25 years from her birth in Philadelphia, her childhood in Baltimore, Maryland, which is my hometown, and her rise to fame in Harlem, culminating with the recording of the song Strange Fruit. I wrote the book about Billie Holiday because she made me. As I said, she's my muse, and I believe she asked me to write the book, and I tried not to write it. Encountered her statue, wax figure, at a wax museum in Baltimore, and I had totally dismissed the idea of writing about her when a little girl walked up and said, "Ooh, Billie Holiday." And I said, "You've heard of her? How old are you?" And I didn't say, "How old are you?" because you don't do that to a woman. I said, what grade are you in?
Very good.
And she said, "I'm in eighth grade." And I said, "You've heard of Billie Holiday?" She said, "Yeah, she could sing." And the little girl walked away and left me standing there with the wax figure. And it was as if the wax figure said to me, "I told you you need to write my book." So I got busy. And the poems, 100 poems poured out of me in a really magical and mystical way over a period of 2 months, which was just really incredible. And then 24 hours later, I got an offer for the book as soon as I submitted it, which is also unheard of. So I like to say that's the book that I was born to write. Billie Holiday was, I think, the greatest singer of the 21st century. Ironically, the book starts with a poem about a Time magazine article that panned her song, Strange Fruit, which became her signature song. Well, at the end of the century, you know, there were all these best of lists, and the song of the century was designated as Strange Fruit. So Time magazine had really come full circle.
Takes a while for some of the messages, particularly the more painful ones, to sink in. So Billie Holiday is your muse, but John Coltrane is somebody you have a personal connection with, you found out.
Right. In the process of researching my book before John was a jazz giant, at that time I lived in High Point, and I went to the High Point Historical Museum to look at the exhibition that the museum, permanent exhibition that the museum has. And in that exhibition, I noticed a picture of his third grade class, and the caption read that his teacher was Tara Whitten, who was my great aunt, whom I had never met. So I found that personal connection in the process of writing the book. But I wanted to write a book that was based in North Carolina and based in my hometown, and we had just put up a historical marker honoring John Coltrane in High Point, and I thought, well, maybe I'll write a children's book about this.
And you've taken it forward and written a children's book about the roots of rap as well.
Right. That's my latest release. And my kids, just as my kids led me to children's literature and reintroduced me to children's literature when I was a young mother, they also reintroduced me to rap music because they were listening to it. And I thought, well, maybe I should write a children's book about this. And it took me about 10 years to get it published. It languished for a while in my file cabinet and then found a home and came out in January.
The music had evolved by then.
But right, the music had evolved and I had developed a hip-hop course at Fayetteville State University in the meantime, and then finally got the book published.
And Georgerie, obviously this music is very much alive today, and that's something that you do, is to make sure that children are not only knowing about it but practicing the music.
Absolutely. Right? Do we do that with Bump the Triangle? That's starting a wonderful program in the fall called Ubuntu Music Academy. We're inviting everyone to visit our website and consider providing a scholarship for a child, and you'll get the scholarship named after you. I'm also taking a new step, Frank, which is starting a new for-profit organization, which is actually the logical next step after Bump, and this will supply music education materials for educators across the country to help them teach music of the African diaspora.
And also practice, will it be sort of curricula to know the history, or is there also will kids be playing music?
It'll be both. Mm-hmm. So we'll provide curriculum for teaching history and culture, as well as musical scores that teachers can use to teach beginners, intermediate, and advanced students. We're really excited because Bump is partnering with an organization called Musical Empowerment and with North Carolina Central to launch Ubuntu in the fall. And I'm delighted that my new company will be supplying the materials for this partnership.
Georgerie Bledsoe is a musicologist and the founder and executive director of Bump the Triangle. Carol Boston Weatherford is a professor at Fayetteville State University, a poet and author of a new children's book. She is author of many. The latest is Roots of Rap, 16 Bars on the Four Pillars of Hip Hop. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Frank.
You can find links to their work at our website, stateofthings.org. You can also sign up for our newsletter and get a daily preview of our lineup. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.